Welcome back to Bad Gay Movies. Thank you for joining us for episode 178. This is, as usual, your intro host, Bill Antoniou. And what are the news to talk about this week? I believe since I last recorded this, the writer's strike wrapped up. The actor strike is still going on. Maybe it will resolve itself by the time this is released. Who knows? Everything's all about making me look bad. Hopefully that does resolve soon. I mean, aside from the fact that I care, we are, even here in Canada, affected by this ongoing situation. And it would be nice to audition for things again. Although, my agent is really hot, so I could totally find uses for him. Anyway, I'm going to get fired just for saying that. I recently went to a wonderful event at Glad Day Bookshop. They are, of course, getting a plug from me a second week in a row. An evening hosted by the great Pearl Harbor with a myriad of performances, including another second week in a row promoting this character. The great Ryan G. Hines sang a couple of tunes, and it was lovely, lovely to catch up with him. And the event was promoting the release of the book Dragging Mason County by Curtis Campbell, who you will remember has been on the show a couple times, most recently talking about The Fan with Lauren Bacall, which he was marvelous on. I can't wait to have him back. I look forward to having Ryan G. Hines back on again. Of course, he was too busy for me this season, but whatever. Curtis's book is available from Anik Press. It is, as Curtis always is, very funny, very brilliant, and very apropos to this current insanity that we're all living through with drag queens suddenly becoming a conservative's worst nightmare for some reason, as if any of them stay up later than 8 p.m. And you know, what else is there to say about that? I have a feeling that if you're listening to this podcast, I don't really need to explain that to you. And so I apologize for preaching to the converted, but everyone out there, no one's interested in your kids. I went to a dinner party once that was like super fancy. You know, this lawyer couple who had us all over and they served everyone steak with like the proper steak knives and everything. Like it was sheesh. And this one couple, who are friends of mine and I do like these people, they brought their toddler to sit in like a high chair next to me while I'm wearing a blazer and eating a steak. Anyway, and I'm, you know, trying to talk to my friends about whatever I talk about at dinner parties, you know, the latest Madonna shenanigans or what was the best film of 1974. And every 5 seconds I'm being interrupted with like, Bill, look, he wants to talk to you, Bill, look, he's eating a steak, Bill. And it's like, Jesus Christ, I don't fucking care about your kid. Like, the idea that anyone would want to get into a relationship with the most boring human beings on the planet, I don't know. Again, pure insanity. The point being that I think the best film of 1974 was probably La Comme Lucien, but I'm not sure. I'd have to check my notes. The real point being that Curtis's book is out, and you should all buy it. Again, Dragging Mason County, available from Anik Press. Now, on to the business of the day. I'm sorry to talk for so long. We are talking about the film Closet Monster, which brings us very close to home because this is a Canadian film shot in Mount Pearl, Newfoundland, where one of my best friends grew up. And you'll hear all about that. And speaking of favorite guests, I love having Gregory Roseborough on every time he does. He is so smart and so funny and far too sexy for radio, but he self-describes himself a social worker in healthcare, a film studies alumnus, a frequenter of Toronto's repertoire movie theaters, and most of all, a bitchy gay man. Find us on the web at badgaymovies.com. Write to us, badgaymovies2013@gmail.com. Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram. Enjoy the show.
Gonna bake and make your dinner. Be your
Welcome to Bad Gay Movies. I am your co-host, Bill Antoniou, and with me is...
Daniel Krolik!
There you are. You remember.
Hi! Yes, it's been so long!
Daniel, every once in a while, there's a writer's strike in the States that is slowing up production here, and none of us are working, and that's when I decide it's time for us to make fun of a Canadian movie and really make sure that we remain as unemployed as possible.
And here we are.
Here we are. And here we are with our lovely guest, one of my absolute favorites, my favorite movie buddy, just the loveliest fellow who ever there was, my dear Gregory Roseborough. Say hello.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Greg's a good friend of mine as well. He just likes the movie Green Book a little bit too much for my liking.
Oh, this one again. Good Lord.
Well, if we have time at the end of the pod, we can litigate this.
Or maybe not. I don't know. I like that movie more than I'm supposed to, too. So, I don't know. Sue us all. Throw us in jail.
Yeah, I think it's going to be like the end of Death Becomes Her when our body parts are scattered at the at the bottom of the steps and yeah. We'll still be fighting over Green Book.
Do you remember where you parked the car? That's how every gay man relationship ends up.
Absolutely.
And apropos that, we have a cast member of Death Becomes Her in today's film who actually turned her Death Becomes Her age this year. Because if she says, I am 71 years old. And that is actually the age she turned.
That is only my second favorite Isabella Rossellini performance.
After
my first one is, damn it, Jack, you know how much I love my roast beef and cheddar.
Damn it, Jack, you know how much I love my big beef and cheddar. You may continue your career for 10 years, 10 years of perfect, unchanged beauty. But at the end of that time, you must disappear. You can vanish. You can stage your own phony death. Or as one of my clients simply said, I want to be alone. Anyway, it's my one good accent impersonation is my Isabella Rossellini, which does wonders at parties, sex parties especially. The film we are doing today is Stephen Dunn's Closet Monster from 2015, shot in St. John's, a lot of it shot in Mount Pearl, home of one of my very best friends. Co-starring an actor I have interviewed. We'll get into it later. And this is a film highly celebrated in Canada at the time. It won the Best Canadian Feature at TIFF. It was named as one of Canada's top 10 of the year. Although, given that we only make 9 movies a year, I don't know that that's much of an accomplishment. And it won the Best Canadian Film at Inside Out the following spring. This film was chosen by my dear lovely Greg for today's film. When I asked him to be on the show, this is the film we to do. He said, what's that movie called where Isabella Rossellini does the voice of the rat? By the way, it's a hamster. And then I said to Daniel, we're doing Closet Monster. Please make sure you can join us. And Dan said, is that the one where Isabella Rossellini voices the rat? So apparently that's the most memorable aspect of the movie. But getting into discussion of this film, Gregory, would you please tell us what inspired this choice?
Sure. Yeah. So I saw this movie when I was living in Vancouver, and it was a weird time when my partner was interested in like looking up movies that were showing and like taking an interest in like queer indies and Canadian movies that got buzz. So we went in 1 month to see Sleeping Giant, which was good, and we saw this. and we left with two different responses. He thought it wasn't that bad and thought there was parts of it that were that resonated and were artful, and thought it was overall like a decent like first or like first feature or, you know, early feature.
Right.
And
first feature. In fact, it's Stephen Dunn's only feature film. Since then, he has created and developed and directed The New Queer as Folk, the one with Kim Cattrall.
Which I have to say is very good.
Okay, all right.
I think it was a pity that it got canceled after one season, because it showed a lot of promise.
Yeah,
it was going to a lot of cool places. And obviously, if you're doing Queer as Folk in 2022, you're going to have to diversify. You're going to have to show people that weren't represented. And they managed to do it in a way that wasn't at all checkboxy.
Right.
That felt super organic. The cherry on top of the Queer as Folk Sunday was the reboot took place in New Orleans. Nobody used a dialect. to make it less complicated, except for Kim Cattrall, who is giving us complete Blanche DuBois.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she's not good at accents. I love her, but she's not. Anyway, Greg, go on.
No, it's fine. It's this movie that's stuck in my craw. I don't know why. It's not even that bad. Like when right. you really apart. It's just.
Well, this is what I want to talk about, because this is a movie where I don't know why. Like, I just don't like it, but I feel like it does get a lot of things correct. It's just boring. And I remember thinking it was boring when I saw it in the theater. But I also was questioning myself watching it again last night. Like, what is it that I don't like about this movie?
Yes.
I have questions about that more than I have answers. And I'm hoping you will help me.
Because this movie has, to me, it has a really appealing aesthetic. It sort of has like a punk, neon David Bowie-ish aesthetic, which I think if you turn the volume off, it would be a cool thing to play at the back of a party.
Right.
But the story is so inert and so bogged down, and it didn't seem like Stephen Dunn did any kind of a job connecting the threads from one beat to the next in terms of how these characters are thinking and what they're doing with their lives.
Is that what it is? Because I know that it presents itself as this kind of combination coming-of-age body horror movie, but it feels more like a standard coming-of-age movie with moments that veer into body horror imagery, but it doesn't really land.
No.
It's not situated enough in that for it to be that different from other coming-of-age movies I've seen.
And I think you're in real trouble when the best performance of the movie is given by the hardware store boss who has maybe 2.5 minutes.
I mean, I have never seen Mary Walsh being used more for just her financial potential, basically, which is that you put her on the grant application and suddenly you get more money to make your movie. Because we were Peter Kinnett and I were talking about her in Mambo Italiano not long ago. At least she gets to do stuff in that film. In this movie, she really does just seem to be there for financial reasons.
But she's also the only point in the movie where I sort of perked up and listened to what somebody was saying.
You weren't excited by the hamster? There are more than two genders, and they are all in that hamster.
Listen,
that,
Bill,
I've
been excited by hamsters plenty times in my life. This was not one of them.
I wonder if, because the thing is that the themes in this movie, it gets them all correct. The internalization of homophobia thanks to a childhood trauma is not outrageous. It's pretty accurate. Even the way he behaves, like when he first becomes obsessed with, what's the, Alyosha Schneider is the name of the, Peter.
The Jolly Quebecois?
Correct.
Wilder was his name.
Oh, I thought his name was Peter.
Oh, on IMDb, he's Wilder.
Oh, I got it wrong then. He is obsessed with him and, like goes to that party and just like, even though it's a totally fun party, he just sulks like an idiot because he's obsessed with the fact that the guy he likes, he isn't there. He's not paying attention to him. That's all, again, very accurate to the age. Even making up conversations with your pet is accurate. Like imagining this relationship that you have with the pet that you love. So why is it that it's not working for me? Is it that this movie spells things out a bit too clearly? Like when he looks down at his dick after masturbating and it's the metal rod, like, is that too on the nose? Is that what's a problem for me?
I don't think that Stephen Dunn endowed any character in this movie with any kind of internal life.
Right.
And like, I'm thinking about the parents again, and the dad's behavior seems so erratic from one moment to the next.
Yes.
And even this kid, like the fact that you're giving him an aptitude for makeup and for horror movie makeup and for making these cool, disgusting things out of makeup is such a specific passion to have, but the character itself remains so generic.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the parents are inconsistently drawn, and there's moments in the movie where I'm like, wait a minute, I didn't realize we were dealing with a deadbeat dad. I just saw him 5 minutes ago.
Completely. Yeah. And it's also because Aaron Abrams, I think, is a very likable presence, but he gives off sort of doofus sitcom dad. Or like, you know, bumbling, I'm doing the best that I can, single dad. So when he sort of says, get out of my house, you fucking faggot, it's whiplash.
Yeah, because he also kept replacing the hamster secretly when it would die and he would get him a new one, which is why he had a hamster for like 30 years, you know, because Isabella says at the end, you know that I'm not, you know, whatever. Which speaks to a tenderness, right? That he, it's not that he is resentfully getting him another one, but that he doesn't want the kid to even know that his hamster died. The parents are the biggest fail in this movie. Does not look, her age is wrong. I don't know what this, like, first of all, she's not Leanne Balaban. I had to keep reminding myself this because that's just a type in Canadian movies that they always cast in roles.
Or like Mia Kirshner, maybe.
Right, where it's like, you're not from this part of Canada. I don't believe it. I never really believed that she was his mom. And she's a good actress. There's no complaint there. The casting is the worst with the parents because they're both good actors. Aaron Abrams is the actor I have interviewed. He's the loveliest guy. I was part of the press junket for Young People Fucking, and he couldn't have been nicer. He also was the student of a good friend of mine. He is wonderful, but maybe the director wanted to be creative in casting against type, but this does not seem to be a decision made on what kind of person he is. Or if he is actually angry or, as you said, erratic, because he's not a complicated person who is angry against his will, where he's trying to do the best he can, but he can't help but blow into these rages. He literally changes his mind about who he is in every scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wonder if that is the contribution of Aaron Abrams to the role, or if that's just how it's drawn on the page. And from the beginning of the movie, I think we're going to get this interesting portrayal of like a common kind of parental homophobia where from the moment where he asked the dad why they had impaled that kid.
Right.
And dad's like, well, cause he was gay. And it sets an interesting tone that I'm signing up. I will sign up for the rest of the movie. Like, oh, okay. This is a dad who will never say being gay is okay. So this kid will de facto grow up hating himself.
Right.
But then there's these moments where the dad all of a sudden is more brusque or even more brutal. And then him throwing the milk in his face after the kid calls him a batshit crazy, I believe is what he calls him. And in that moment, I'm supposed to feel on the side of the kid, Oscar, but I actually in that moment was thinking like, yeah, throw milk in his face. He's being a brat. Because the movie hasn't done a good job spelling out to me that the dad sucks.
Well, it also hasn't done a good job of the way it talks about his trauma because he's so accurately aware, like, because he keeps thinking of the metal rod, right? So it's like, and usually that kind of trauma, you internalize it and then black it out, which is why it returns to you in your life, is because you're not actually consciously aware of it. He's consciously aware because he's like, every time anything the slightest bit gay comes up, he's like, oh, but that kid got a metal rod up his ass, which I remember in exact detail. So the fact that he's then acting out like a shitty teenager, because that's how shitty teenagers act, because they can't articulate their feelings. You can't have both, basically, and then have me be on his side because you've already told me that he is smart enough to know what's going on with him.
And I think not only did the movie need so much work from a dramaturgical element to get like the character's intention so much clearer, but also this movie, both the first time that I saw it and this time, I saw it the first time because it was advertised as a queer punk movie where Isabella Rossellini voices a talking hamster. Yeah. So I feel like this movie, Yes. So I feel like this movie promised this like queer acid trip on the label that we absolutely were not given.
No, we were not.
Yeah.
And you forgot, her name is Buffy as well. Buffy.
Yeah, because he loves Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is why he has the stake at the beginning, right? When he's a kid.
Yeah, but it's such a loose connection because like, again, like all of his like fantasy sci-fi passions never seem to manifest themselves in any sort of really interesting way.
Yeah, it investigates things pictorially and not psychologically and pretends that it is, and that's kind of annoying. And it's also what makes it kind of boring. Also because most of the characters are not interesting. They are all vague approximations of people.
My favorite scene was when he was talking with a girlfriend about going to New York and she's like, oh, I can't wait to audition for all these big Broadway shows. And he's like, you know, it'd be lucky to get into the room. That there are thousands of people who are better looking than you and probably more talented.
I also, that the scene that he witnesses at the beginning of these kids like shoving a metal rod up another kid's ass, which is just like beyond the pale.
It really ruined metal rods for me.
I know. I was waiting for Greg to be like, don't knock it till you tried it. So no, of course, it's a totally, you know, awful thing. And I don't know how that kid doesn't die. But those kids are suspiciously successful in getting that thing in there as well. I mean, they just knock that kid down on the ground, and the next thing you know, it's just being like, yep. No pants come off, nothing, just goes right in there. I mean, I don't want to victim blame, but I just, the logistics of it. Greg, don't laugh when you're on mute.
Okay. It's really funny.
I mean, I just mean that the power of showing me something that brutal is somewhat diminished when the logic of it starts to, not make sense to me.
I just want to, like, aesthetically nitpick as well. Whenever these flashbacks or childhood sequences are done in Canadian movies, there's always, I think this was something I bitched about in the Firebird episode as well, there's always this blue color about it all.
Oh, yeah.
I hate that. I hate blue gels.
Well, I don't like how ugly Newfoundland is in this movie because it's actually a beautifully shot movie, but then Newfoundland also looks really drab in it, and I don't like
that. And I think the aesthetic made me think that it was taking place in another era, that it wasn't taking place in the present day. Yeah, so when everybody started whipping out smartphones and laptops, I was a little bit confused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it enters a new realm when he's working at like a Home Depot.
Yeah.
The only time where it establishes a sense of place and it feels local is when he's working in the hardware store, which makes it look like small town Canada.
Yeah.
And then when he ends up in his internship at Fogo Island, when we really feel like we're in beautiful Newfoundland. By the way, that's Fogo Island, his plan B to going to Brooklyn.
Right. Why? I didn't understand. What did he get? Fogo Island, for those listening who don't know, is like a tiny island off the, I believe, northeast coast.
I didn't know that until the second, and I literally just watched this movie.
Why is he there doing an internship with whom?
Yeah, so it was like after he gets refused by the
arts New York makeup,
he only applied to one. He tells his mom his future is over because he didn't get into one arts program.
Well, sweetie. He's a teenager, that's how you feel. Yeah.
Sure. And then his mom says to him, you know, why don't you consider doing like an artist residency at Fogo? And Fogo, for listeners, it's an elite, like, premium vacation destination. Like you can get some really expensive, like Airbnbs or hotel stays.
Yeah. I mean, he looks like he's in like something shot in Iceland or something when he's
completely
there. Strange house and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, and they put people up to make art inspired by the scenery. And like one of Toronto's like textiles artists did an internship up there and made expensive pajamas.
Right. So it's any kind of art?
Any kind of art.
So what's he doing out there? Is he still doing makeup or?
I don't know. It looks like, but from what he's hanging on his walls, it looks like he's just doing sketches.
Okay. All right.
But it also didn't look like he was part of an artist community or his colony. He looked like it was some sort of like futuristic prison.
Yeah.
Where he was like sentenced to live on an island by himself.
It looked like Ex Machina. That's why I was like, wait, what did I miss? Yeah.
And it was also so beautiful that it made me laugh at the idea that like, oh, this poor thing, he got refused entry into the art school that he wanted to go to in Brooklyn. He didn't get to live his Brooklyn dream. I guess he'll just have to settle for Fogo Island.
Yeah. I also love when he is working at the box store, this couple comes in looking to buy a door. They're like, we have a new house and we need a door, which I've never heard this before in my life. She is wearing a cocktail dress and high-heeled shoes. They say, we just got married. I'm like, what, like this morning did you just get married? Like they're dressed up at Home Depot and they need a door.
Good first draft.
Yeah. Well, but, and that's the general problem with this movie is that there's vagueness to everything.
And you're right, Bill, because even these two randoms who are in one scene don't seem to have any kind of internal life.
No, they're friends or they're from like the local, they just graduated from acting school or they're doing a show at Neptune or something, which is not in
Neptune. Neptune is far.
Yeah.
Neptune is in Halifax.
I know, Daniel, I know. It's the only part of the Maritimes I've been to.
There's two movies in this one crammed together and they're really asynchronous. One of them is this twee-ish Michael Cera movie where it's about somebody who's friends with a hamster that can talk and they work in a hardware store and they have aspirations of getting out of their small town and they're quirky and they're artistic. And then there's this other one, which is about somebody who watches homophobic violence as a kid. And now every time they get a boner, they imagine they have a metal rod coming out of their stomach.
Yeah.
And it kind of oscillates between
never the twain shall meet.
Never.
Yeah, and again, very on the nose. The fact that he expels the rod from himself at the end, I just feel like that's something that if the director had described it to me, I thought, oh, that's cool, you know. But then when you see it, there's just something not profound about it. That
no,
yeah.
Even though that final scene where he threatens his dad with the rod is effective.
Yes, and there are a lot of effective moments in this movie. But again, the vagueness, the fact that I don't know what's going on with this divorce situation. It happens a lot that when parents divorce, the kid ends up with the dad. It's not what we expect, but it does happen. Two of my closest friends, that is the case. But I feel like I needed more information as to why he was being raised by this dad who is also such a jerk.
And the final confrontation between the mom and the dad on the front yard with all of the ruined stuff and, right. and the hamster, it sounded like Stephen Dunn just said, scream at the top of your lungs and say whatever you want.
Right. But also, does she come over and do that a lot? Because I felt like she left and never looked back.
She dropped out for most of the movie.
Right. And then
except when she wanted that fur hat.
And when he's staying with her, it doesn't seem like he's there regularly. When she leaves, it feels like she's leaving to go to another country. It doesn't feel like she's leaving.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he was there regularly. And I was waiting for some kind of, well, I don't want to be here because I don't like your new husband. I don't like this new family that you have. Or she's saying, well, you know, I like my new family better and, you know, I'm not comfortable being like anything, well, yeah, like, anything for us to latch onto as an audience.
And leave him to be raised completely by his dad? Or does she check in every once in a while? Because also, again, casting that actress who's not, she doesn't seem like a local Newfoundlander to say that she's from this small town. They knew each other in high school and living on the other side of the town is like living on the other side of Mount Pearl is the other side of the world from him as far as she's concerned. I don't get that impression. So it's like, why were you with this guy in the first place? And why haven't you gone that far? What is your feeling about your kid? These are all things that are, I don't know that I need full exposition, but I mean, we've seen good movies where there's a specificity to the way everything's happening where you don't need it explained and you just feel the dynamics of the relationship. And I feel like that's what's missing here.
It sounds like nobody did their homework.
Yeah, or the director maybe never cracked how to make it show. I don't know.
And the kid, I don't know the name of the guy who played our lovely protagonist.
Connor Jessup.
Yeah. Oh, him! Sure, yeah.
Who's actually gay in real life.
Yeah. Great, and Connor Jessup is an attractive man who is good-looking on camera, but sort of beyond that didn't give me anything.
Yeah, I mean, he's cute. He's a cute Newfoundland white guy. That's what they look like. Yeah.
I thought Connor Jessup was doing a good job. I thought that I never had an issue with his performance. The issue I was having was that the way his character is drawn is, to your point, Bill, he's just too knowing. He's too self-knowledgeable. And like coming out has especially the more closeted part of it has bratty, messy features to it. And this kid is just so self-aware. I think that's the point you're making about like the steel rod coming out. It's too perfectly visualized. It's too complete of a metaphor. It seems like this really cerebral kid even drew it on paper and was like, and that is going to be my trauma.
And there's also several relatively recent Canadian movies that are coming of age stories that I could think of, with sort of like a magical realism uplift that really, really succeeded. Like I'm thinking of Crazy by Jean-Marc Vallée, which had any number of really fantastical moments, but they all tied into sort of this greater picture of who this person was and why they're trying to get out of their town.
Define recent.
That's what I said, relatively. Yeah. And there was a Quebecois movie from maybe a decade ago. I think the kid was a gay, called C'est pas moi, je le lure.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Which also really made an impact on me. That also had sort of a wayward mom in it.
There's the movie. Doesn't Saint Ralph involve an imaginary character? I can't remember.
I think so. I haven't seen it.
Campbell Scott, and I think Jennifer Tilly is in that as a nurse.
Oh, okay.
Charming film, yeah.
A fun fact about Connor Jessup: when I looked him up, he directed a short documentary about a pitch at Pong We're a Sithicool that's on the Criterion Channel.
Really?
Okay.
I did not know that. That's cool.
It is cool.
Is that the director of Uncle Boomy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay.
Famously known to his friends just as Joe.
Great.
Or Ty Joe. Tilda will always refer to him as Joe when she's being interviewed about.
Yeah, but Tilda refers to everybody as Joe.
She does. She doesn't learn anyone's name.
So you're saying that I practice saying his name for nothing. Great.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. I can see you in front of your mirror, and every time you do it wrong, you just hit yourself.
Chuck Pong.
I will sell a house today.
Yes.
That reminds me, I have to watch Memoria again. I really love that movie.
I'm going to see it for the first time.
You're a fool. The boys in bed after the party overnight is a lovely scene. That's a scene that I watched again, and I thought they get a lot right in that scene to talk about things that we do like. The way that the straight guy is just cool and friendly, and he's just like in the misery that he's in. And then it ruins it, because then the next scene is him with his mom, and everything is just like dramatically incorrect about that relationship.
Yeah, although there was a hint at what the relationship could have been in this really cool line that she says to him, where she says, you know, if you're going to walk through shit your whole life, you might as well grow a thick skin.
Yeah.
That would be a really cool way to build out the whole character of the mom from that. This person who doesn't take ownership of how she has fucked her kid up, but also tells her kid, get a thick skin.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also these parents talk in these big grand platitudes that neither of them deserve, because we don't know anything about them.
Well, and also they're so glamorous. Like I would love it if she was saying grow a thick skin and also had like a bad perm and a permanent cigarette hanging out of her mouth. And just,
I mean, that's what I want from every mother in any movie.
Someone local is what I'm trying to say. Like his dad is supposed to be that kind of loving trash. And like, the mom, again, she looks like she just graduated law school or something. You know what I mean? Like, she's so clean.
Yeah. Not that people can't be clean in Newfoundland.
No, of course not. Like, I don't mean
let's
that.
Not come for it. Yeah.
But, you know, there's no one bourgeois on that. No, I'm just kidding. Mm-mm. And she looks exactly like my best friend from Newfoundland. But that's not the point. Also, the lack of joy in this movie. I mean, there's always this obsession we have when we're making a film about a serious subject that we're afraid that if we, Canadians are particularly bad for this, that if we lighten up and include humor or passion or whatever, if he, God forbid, enjoyed sex while then being complicated, conflicted about it, coughing up nails or whatever it is that he spits up in that tank. Like, how much more enjoyable would the movie be if he let himself get carried away before then being pulled back by the guilt and shame?
And again, this is a movie where Isabella Rossellini voices a talking hamster that suffers from a gigantic lack of joy.
Right. And that's such a moment of whimsy that it's like, why isn't that more fun? And how many animals is Isabella Rossellini going to narrate in her life? I mean,
infinite numbers.
Yeah. She works in Canada a lot too. We seem to have a real connection for her.
Well, we're lucky to have her.
Madden a lot, yeah. I mean, she's always lovely. I adore her. I've never watched any of her green pornos. I've always meant to, and I've never watched any of them. But
how do you think they got her for this movie?
I don't know. Like I said, she's worked in Canadian cinema many times, and but yeah, I would be curious to know the direct line to offering her this. I think she also probably did not leave her house. Like she could, wherever she was in the world, she could have just recorded her dialogue without having to be inconvenienced in the slightest. And she probably could have done it all in one day.
And it's possible that it looked interesting on the page more than it just carried out in execution.
Yeah. There might also be funding from somewhere other than Canada in this movie that, you know, necessitated her being involved. I'm not sure. Forgot to look that up. I also love in movies whenever anyone goes grocery shopping and they're holding grocery bags, there's always got to be one bag with a loaf of bread sticking out of it and one bag with the greens sticking out of it. That's all I can think about in that scene where Aaron Abrams accosts the girlfriend in the parking lot.
Who again is set up as a major character but drops out for at least a good half hour.
It's okay. She's boring anyway.
Oh, wait a minute. Is it Aaron Abrams who's carrying the breadstick and the vegetables, because
isn't it
be a deadbeat dad? That should have just been Oreos.
Yeah. Or fish sticks.
I mean, I also remember the first time I watched this movie constantly being surprised that I was finding out he was a jerk, because everything I was seeing was telling me otherwise. And it wasn't just because he's such a naturally likable person.
Absolutely. I feel validated that you both had the same takeaway, because it caught me by surprise at the moment when the dad's going through the kid's photo album and he sees that he's a deadbeat dad. And I thought, wait, he's a deadbeat dad? I thought he was just like, I thought this movie was going to tell us the story of a father who's complicated in that he loves his kid, but has been raising him homophobically.
No, it really is about the confusion. Because also when Oscar comes home from the part, is it from the party when he's killed the hamster? He's thrown the hamster out the window.
Right, right.
He looks really, really upset and guilty about everything that's transpired. And it's like, again, I need information. Is this something that happens all the time, that he rages and then feels regret, which is what a lot of abusive people do? Mm-hmm. The, you know, please take me back, I'm sorry, it won't happen again thing. Because I didn't know. I it was all just a blur. This movie is a bit too vague.
Yeah. And right at the end, when he picks up the spike and you think he's going to start stabbing the dad,
mm-hmm.
right at the end of the movie, it took me back to the climax of Roland Emmerich's Stonewall, when you have like the white twink holding up the first brick at the riot, and he's just like, gay power, and he throws the brick.
Yeah. I don't remember that movie at all. I was
You should.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would have to listen to our episode to remind myself of things in that movie. I don't remember that movie at all. I also watched a really lovely short documentary about Stormé de la Verrier. Is that how you say her name? His name?
I think so.
I think she went by her. The actual first brick thrower. Well, not the actual, the reputed first brick thrower at Stonewall.
This movie commits one of my my biggest crimes, one of my biggest pet peeves, which is the arbitrary indie rock soundtrack.
Oh yes, including my the lovely Ali X on the soundtrack, which I actually enjoyed hearing because I love Ali X and I did an acting class with her. She's a great gal.
Yeah, that's cool.
my favorite song of hers, and also that scene is totally stealing from Mommy. But anyway.
Well, yeah, a lot of the soundtrack choices feel like he's trying to create a Xavier Dolan kind of effect. Yeah. But it ends up just all feeling like none of his soundtrack choices are really considered, in that he just kind of like took stuff off of his iPod and put it into the movie.
For sure.
Yeah. We're still saying iPod on BGM, everyone.
Yeah.
It was 2015, so he would have used an iPod.
It's possible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't have a strong feeling about the music, but I did feel like it was kind of pressing too hard to demand a kind of response from me that it wasn't.
Yeah, and usually whenever I encounter a movie like this that in an amateur way uses music to instruct me on how to feel, it's really obvious what it's trying to evoke from me from the minute I hear the needle drop.
Yeah.
This time it seemed really clumsy. It's like, what are you trying to do with this? I'm hearing these words in the songs, and I'm thinking, this has nothing to do with what is happening on screen. You would have been better off just picking like non-vocal parts of the song if you're just trying to create a vibe.
Yeah, I mean, and I also wonder, like, what is the process by which the songs get chosen? Like, what is the financial deals, or are you approached by promoters who want to, you know, sell this music, and or is the film company attached to a music company, and that's why you have a particular library to choose from? I don't know. Yeah, there is a lot of touching on the Dolan effect, which it's like, I don't even want to watch Dolan movies that much, let alone watch like copies of them. So especially Mommy, which is one of my least favorite of his works. Also, is there enough of a connection made in this movie between his horror makeup imagination and the horrors he witnessed as a child?
Absolutely not.
Right.
No.
I couldn't decide if that was supposed to be the case or not.
Unless if you see him actively making these, like when he was doing the photo shoot when he put the horns on his girlfriend, or when like he's flipping through his portfolio, there's no through line about why this is his passion, why he's good at it, why he's obsessed with it. It actually brought me back to, you know, the 1980s movie Dream Child about Alice Liddell.
I've never seen it. I have it on my computer, but I've never seen it.
It's a little bit of a cheap, scrappy movie, but it's really special because it's about Alice from Alice in Wonderland, who is now in her 80s and living in New York, and she's haunted by the characters from Alice in Wonderland, which are Jim Henson Creature Shop. Yeah. But you needed that sort of like swirling fantasy surrounding him, like as if like his monsters were coming to life. And if he's going to name the hamster Buffy, and he's sort of like, why is he into this whole horror movie sci-fi aesthetic? What does it mean to him? And he should be obsessed with it, because also when you're a teenager, those are your obsessions.
And of
course, that is how you see the world.
In reality, Alice was being pursued by Lewis Carroll.
No, we all know that. We know.
But also, his horror imagination doesn't really set him apart either. Like he and his best friend wear horns to school, and there's no reaction.
But there's also literally one scene of them in high school. So outside of that party scene, you right. don't get any sense of how he goes about his life with other
That's what
kids,
I mean. Like he doesn't wear horns to school and gets in trouble from a teacher or gets made fun of by the, and this is a point where children are shoving rods up each other's asses for someone being different. So you would think that sure. there would be more of an attempt made to show how he's
but
not.
There's no sense of community.
Yeah.
You know what movie did that piece better while we're on the topic of Canadian movies? Did either of you ever see Ginger Snaps?
I've only seen the sequel.
Oh, the original.
I have to say it the Madonna way. Sequel.
Sequel.
You don't mean the squeakquel?
Mm-hmm. Hydrangeas. It's been probably 20 years since I've seen it, but I remember I watched it like multiple times when I rented it from Rogers Video. Rogers Video used to be a video store, everyone. Back before iPods. And the movie does this really good job showing how these two sisters are morbid and how their art and how their school projects reflect their inner worlds. And it doesn't have to go too deep and explain it as rooted in a trauma. We just get a sense that these are dark kids.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in this movie, there's a lot about Oscar that is fleshed out. His trauma, his inner conflict about being gay. Yeah, it takes me there. Like it's broad strokes, but it's done like pretty competently.
Yeah.
There's a through line. But his taste for the macabre and for the dark, that's not developed.
Yeah, no, like I said, everything is like on paper correct. I just don't know that I feel it. Which is something worth pointing out, just because a lot of the movies we cover on this show are movies where we wonder, what are these people thinking? What do they think humanity is? Because they don't seem to understand how humans work. And that is not the problem with this movie.
No, this movie was marketed and publicized well enough for me to buy a ticket for it when it first came out, because it looked like something
I don't know why I saw it. Because when I went to see it, I did not know that it was a gay movie. So I don't know what it was that drew me in to see it. Maybe because it was just being lauded as the Canadian film of note and I had time that day and I went to see it. Because I remember sitting down to watch
You didn't know that Isabella voiced the hamster?
But once that happened, I was like, oh, this is going to be about him being gay. Because if he wasn't, it would be Ryan Reynolds voicing that hamster. So... So that was my first tip off.
I mean, I don't know about you, Bill. My fantasy hamster is always voiced by Ryan Reynolds. I mean, it did take me back to the first season of Strangers with Candy, because in the very first season, in every episode, Jerry Blank had a pet, which ended up dying miserably by the end of the episode. Oh, it was a recurring thing that was dropped for later seasons. But Isabella's hamster took me back to all of Jerry's pets in the first season of Strangers with Candy.
I remember watching that show and thinking Stephen Colbert was hot. And my friend said, it's because I like my man.
He was so cute in that show.
I want to talk about this party he goes to.
Yes!
I've gone to my share of parties. I've done my share of socializing in small town Maritimes as a teenager.
Wait, why?
as a kid, I spent every summer in Nova Scotia. My parents had a cottage in Nova Scotia that we went to every summer.
Oh, I think I did know that, yeah.
Yeah, and then as a teenager, I would spend more and more of my summer vacation hanging out with my local friends in their small town, Amherst, Nova Scotia. Looking back, I think I was so stupid. I should have just enjoyed all 5 weeks like on the sandbars. But all I wanted to do was go into town and write movies with my friends and smoke cigarettes. But parties don't look that cool. They do not.
This is another movie conceit, but yeah.
Totally. And I guess this is a problem with teenage movies, teenage portrayals in general, is the parties always look so much more lit than any party I've ever been to. Yeah. Even good teenage movies have this problem. I love the movie Booksmart. That party looks too much fun.
It's true. Yeah. Because also, that's a great point, Greg, because when you're 15 or 16, I mean, I was not a popular 16-year-old, shocker, but you're still figuring out the world around you. You're still figuring out what's good, what you like, what you do want to do, what you don't want to do. Like, you're still testing your boundaries and your limits. So you're right. You don't have it together to throw that kind of a banging party.
It had such a coherent aesthetic. There was people in one room dressing up people who didn't come with costumes.
Yes.
Doing gorgeous face paint, talking about how they might go to Berlin, and now they're not going to Berlin. They're just going to move back to Montreal. Like, they're all so bloody worldly.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, who lives in this house together? And
And also there seemed to be such a theater kid vibe about it that the protagonist would immediately fit into. So I was like, why are you so isolated on this island when there's so many like-minded kids who think like you?
Yeah, and just so I know, no one thinks that we're saying that people in Mount Pearl can't be worldly. I mean, it reminded me of like how no one in my high school parties from Scarborough, Ontario could be worldly either. Like it's a something, it's the suburbanness that's not quite convincing. And also you have this like guest model of a guy who comes up and is like ready to fuck you in the bathroom. Like how lucky is that, that that's what happens at a high school party? That's not what happens at a high school party.
That guy had such great lips and I'm sorry, Smelltown, Newfoundland. You can hate on me. You can write Bill your letters. I don't believe he's from your town. I just don't.
No. He was told. Yeah, he was totally like a like an Italian model or something who was doing a like a some kind of photo shoot because Vogue is doing fishing villages in September or something.
It looks like he fucks Jennifer Coolidge before he tries to assassinate her.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And I is probably straight in real life too. But that was another one where, I mean, first of all, I get that Buddy is obsessed with Wilder, but at the same time, you are a teenager. And like, I was unhealthily obsessed with the straight guy when I was a teenager. I still would have gone to the bathroom with a hot guy who came up. Like, it's not, you're not that focused at that age, right? Like, you take the opportunities where they can, whatever it is that you want.
Totally.
And again, like if we at least got the impression that he liked sex in some way. And also I didn't understand if the other guy hitting on him was even into him or if he was playing a trick on him. Like that was all very murky as well. Like it was, again, this movie raised too many questions for me to enjoy it while at the same time being kind of boring.
The movie would have benefited from a complicated wet dream as well. Like if he has images of steel rods going through people's bodies while he's masturbating, imagine the kind of nightmares he has.
Well, or if he kind of enjoys that as well, because body horror is all about being in some way problematic, right? This is why this is all David Cronenberg's movies, which is that things are disgusting and kinky and exciting and off-putting all at the same time. So,
yeah, good point. We're drawn to it and repelled.
Yeah, and so maybe there should be something about the fact that he likes his sex a bit too violent or something.
But he doesn't seem to like it at all.
Or anything. Like, he doesn't seem to like anything. Because even his, like, makeup stuff is something that you don't get the impression that, like, when he's living his secret makeup-creating life that he's finally himself. Like, nothing seems to infuse him in any way to say that he's his fake self around some people and his real self among others.
A funny story. So in the scene where he throws up bolts after getting fucked for like a minute by the hot guy at the party, the hot guy is all of a sudden horrified, like, oh God, vomit. I got to get out of here.
Yeah, like he's never been to a high school party before.
Yeah, or like he's never
fucked. All those teenagers aren't raping each other while they're barking. But anyway.
Totally. It's just rape barf everywhere.
Yeah.
But Mike walks into the room and says, as if he would do that. Who leaves somebody alone vomiting after having sex with them?
Oh, and then Greg's like, oh, hold on.
I think we have our answer.
Greg looks into the contacts in his phone and he has like a special list.
Well, no. So then I reminded Mike this story of what my coworker told me about one time hooking up with this guy. And he pulled out for a minute and this perfect spherical marble-sized turd landed in the middle of the bed. And they both just looked at each other like deer in headlights. And the bottom said to him, you're not going to leave, are you? And my friend said, no, but I got to go.
And that, my friends, is queer joy. That is why we still need to fight.
You know,
the turd was voiced by Isabella Rossellini.
Try not to feel judged, but like,
oh no, Greg, it was Jennifer Tilly. It was completely Jennifer Tilly.
I just don't know why I'm here. Charmed. Yeah, I mean, listen, you don't want the bottom to feel judged in that situation, but it has to be admitted that the vibe has changed in the room and the mood has shifted, you know. I don't know that I would run out, but I would be like, you know what?
At least, according to the story, at least it was a relatively well-formed turd, and it wasn't just like splatter.
Yeah, I really like that aspect of the story, that you wanted to give us like a sense of tone and depth, you know, really feel the moment.
Because the way I imagined it when it was told to me was that it like, kind of shot out like a cannon.
Wow. That is someone who obviously did not was not prepared for the experience, basically. I think someone was, I think people were taking advantage of an opportunity and they just decided to go with it, and then whatever happens, happens. But listen, sex is often crazy. It can often be dirty. It's, you know, it's whatever happens. The younger you are, the drunker you are, the crazier
sex is
the
party. Natural. Sex is fun. Sex is something for one-on-one.
You know, you're a teenager at a party, that's the more like, and hopefully everyone stays safe and no one has anything happen to them that they don't want. But at the same time, it's going to be a complete disaster shit show. I also want to know about the scene in the bathroom, because it's another case where it's like, all of a sudden they are fully fucking up the ass. Like he makes one move and he's just like right on in there. I mean, there's no Heath Ledger spit on the hand. There's nothing. It's just full penetration within milliseconds.
It seems too much like belonging to sex culture when this party looked populated by people who are still figuring out their sexualities.
Yeah.
And are finding their sexual identities probably more through aesthetic and through artistic expression. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that they're even bothering with a costume party, which, like, who fucking cares?
But again, you never see these kids because there's pretty much no scene set at the school. There's no other parties. They don't come into the Home Depot store. So It's an entire house full of kids you never see again.
Well, again, I want to know, like, is he popular? Does he get invited? Even though he likes to spend his time alone doing makeup, like, do the kids like him or don't they? Does he usually get invited, or is this a rare case of him being invited because Wilder asked him to come?
How many people do you think live in their town?
Well, it's St. John's, so it's not a town. They're just in a suburb.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I know that St. John's is not a huge city, but it's not like I wouldn't think of it as a small town.
Yeah, it's like the size of Whitehorse or something. I'm looking at it.
And they are, like, he is in Mount Pearl, which is like a nice suburb of St. John's, from what I understand, from my friend who's from there. So it's basically like being from my part of Scarborough, the nice part of Scarborough. Thank you.
Yeah, it's like 113,000 people. That's fun.
Yeah. It's not a small town.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's just from a family who's like from the wrong side of the tracks, kind of. And also, what does his father do? Do we establish this?
I don't think it's ever established.
Okay.
He just buys bread and leafy greens at the grocery store.
Yeah, leafy greens.
And yells when he goes into the hardware store. That was so...
Well, that's the other thing. And then he's apparently an alcoholic. And you're like, oh, this is new. I don't know that I got that.
And also, even if you're a shitty deadbeat dad, you're still going to exercise some kind of discretion when you fuck a woman in the house that you share with your son.
I don't know. Again, the character is so erratically drawn that who knows what he's going to do. But also, doesn't everybody know him? So, like, if he comes in screaming in the store, aren't they like, oh, here's Buddy's dad.
Here's crazy old, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of look like he could play a cousin of Josh Lucas in a movie.
Oh, yeah. Aaron Abrams is super cute. It's so funny because the way Canadian actors are treated, because every time he's in something Canadian, he looks so handsome. And then every time he has a small role or whatever in anything American that's shot here, they completely like dampen down everything appealing about him. Like, he's got those lovely big blue eyes and suddenly he looks like complete ass when he's on like Hannibal or whatever it is that he's in.
He came off well in Hannibal, I thought.
Well, I don't know. I remember watching him in something where he just looked terrible, and it was just because they're not going to bother lighting him well the way they are other people.
Right.
And that was something I wanted them to explore a bit too, because there is something compelling about the character of the deadbeat dad who women always fuck. And then they find out he's a deadbeat dad.
For sure, yeah.
For sure, but that might or might not be this character because we don't know anything about him.
Yeah, I guess we kept getting crumbs of what a character could have been, a character that could have been. And I was thinking, oh, that would be something I'd like to watch too, because I'm interested in the character of the dad who is alluring and can pick up at the bar and can get like five girlfriends a year. He just can't hold on to them.
Yeah.
Like, that is a common deadbeat dude, let alone dad.
Yeah, like, what's the appeal he has? Or does he only attract, like, the women with the I can fix him vibe? Is that what it is? Yeah. Also, why is he playing this role? Like, I like Aaron Abrams a lot, but with him and the woman playing the mom, like, why aren't there people who are more convincingly Newfoundlander and more convincingly working class, I'm sorry to say, playing these roles instead of these what are obviously, like, trained spiffy Toronto actors.
I agree. I will say, though, of all of the actors in the movie, second only to Mary Walsh, she was the most convincing as a Maritimer.
Sure.
For me.
Wait, I mean, you know better than I do. So
second
sure.
only to Mary Walsh, who was the most convincing?
The dad. I thought he was the closest. Oh. Which, like, by not... By a long shot, though. Like, I'm saying, like, he was the closest. The mom reminded me of Chantal Kravyazik.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. Yeah. All right. I think we've done enough on this.
But if you're listening, I would recommend the first season of Queer as Folk, of the new Queer as Folk.
I do need to get around to it.
Stephen Dunn really grew by leaps and bounds in between one and the other.
Greg, my lovely sweetie pie, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for suggesting this and I guess making me watch this movie again. I'll take it out on you in some form or another soon. Tell the listeners. Sorry, what?
I just want to ask, is this the first time we've all rewatched a movie that we've seen in theaters for BGM?
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder.
Oh, maybe.
I wonder. Yeah.
Maybe.
Oh.
I watched this. I saw two movies back to back. It was this, and I think it was Maggie's Plan with Greta Gerwig.
Oh, yeah.
And when underrated Julianne Moore performance, when Julianne Moore is like the crazy Nordic performance artist. She's funny in that movie.
She's like German, I think, in that movie. I think she's doing a German accent.
Or something. It's off the charts. It's great.
Yeah, that's a movie. That's my least favorite kind of movie, which is that it starts out really great and I'm excited about it. And then somewhere it goes off the rails and ruins it. I'd kind of rather a movie just be middling from the beginning so that I know what I'm in for, you know. I do like things about that movie. Greg, thank you as always for being on the show. It's genuinely a pleasure. You are so very wise as a cultural commentator. And of course, your knowledge of film is super impressive. And of course, your friendship with me going to movies is one of the great pleasures of my life. Tell the listeners where...
Are you dying, Bill?
I might.
What's... okay.
When I'm done with him.
Yeah. Tell the listeners where they can find you, follow you, all the rest.
Well, to be honest, they can't follow me anywhere because I had my Instagram account taken away from me for spreading false information about Margaret Atwood.
Right.
So, sorry, I don't think it was false, but I think they think that I was.
No, she's been stalking my friend for a long time, so.
Yeah. No, I have nothing to promote, but for people, just because I've been on your podcast two or three times now, for people who are curious to know, I work in harm reduction services, and if you want to go and educate yourself a little bit, learn about how oxygen works in responding to an overdose, and then... And then push your city councilors to get it operationalized in shelters because the poison supply crisis is still continuing.
Yeah, true that. On that happy note, Daniel, tell our listeners where to follow you. This is coming out in the fall, so promoting.
So I don't. I probably won't have a show, but you can look me up on Instagram at either KrolikD, KrolikD, or you can give us a follow at Gay for Pay Productions. Myself and Curtis Campbell, frequent guest of the show, wrote Gay for Pay with Blake and Clay and its upcoming sequel, Blake and Clay's Gay Agenda. Yeah. Although now it's fall, so it's no longer upcoming.
It's the past sequel, but you're working on part 3 of the search for Spock, and it's going to be amazing. And follow us at Bad Gay Movies on all the socials, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram. Write to us at badgaymovies2013@gmail.com. Visit us on the web at badgaymovies.com. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Bye.
Adios.